So now we're going to open it up to discussion. And, there's a lot in anarchist activist culture that seems to be self-marginalization and defeatist and often, just not have power analysis. So I'm hoping that these discussions are going to be constructive and that we're going to challenge and develop a more micro orientation to anarchist organizing methodology, because we have a lot to offer on the macro level, but it once again brings us back to the question of how are we going to reach this level of social organization that we are saying we're politically committed to. And I think that really is through talking about anarchist power analysis and strategy and organization. And I, before we open up the discussion, I just wanted to say, some of these discussions have been taking place already. In Boston, we had a non-sectarian radical organizers conference where we talked a lot about the gap between vision and practice and theory and action. And in Boston, Worcester, and Providence, some of us have started discussions about these same tensions. And so you can talk to Matt from Worcester. I think McKay is here from Boston, or myself, if you want to contribute or participate in those discussions. But so I'll open it up to questions, or if you have comments, if you can try to keep it to 1 or 2 minutes, that would be great. And Eric is keeping time, so if you can keep an eye out on him. And so any questions or comments, experiences that you'd want to share?
I must have pissed somebody off.
I actually love what she said. There was, in each of the speakers, y'all touched in sort of the tension between reforms and trying to have a revolutionary goal or revolutionary vision. And I read two things recently. Well, one of them I read a long time ago, but the other one was much more recently. And they were both by Noam Chomsky, and I really appreciated them. And I think that they put in succinctly what sort of tension that you all are describing. One is an essay he wrote called Goals and Visions. And another one is an interview he had talking about the situation in Brazil and his involvement with that. In the essay in Goals and Visions, he basically puts out something that I really agree with, and I think that it's something that anarchists have had a lot of trouble grappling with, even though it seems to like be common sense notion. And that's basically any vision, overall vision that you have in society is going to need certain steps. It's going to need a process. It's going to need certain ways of doing it. And so you need to outline certain goals. I think it's perfectly fine to work on reformist campaigns as long as you maintain that vision. And anytime you kind of lose that balance between those small steps to reach your greater vision, you really contribute to some of the pseudo-societal tendencies we have in activism. If you work solely on reforms and have no vision, then we all know the experience, you end up getting nowhere. And if you have a vision, you never engage politically to have any goals in there. You either kind of hope for just some spontaneous insurrection out of the blue, or you kind of just carve out your own utopia and isolate yourself from everyone else. The other point that he made in an interview, we talked about Brazil, he touched upon that again, but he also said in Brazil, they have this idea that we expand the cage as much as possible till the bars disappear. And that for me is really kind of succinctly metaphoric explaining that process between having goals and vision. And especially in being realistic about what world we live in, he says we expand the cage, and we're also very aware of sometimes the dangers that exist outside the cage to protect us. And that's something that I think that we, as activists and people who are interested in social change work, we need to keep in mind that we don't live in the society that we envision. And we have to keep those practical points in line. And that freedom, for me, is really about possibility and what is possible. Not something that I just kind of grab out of fear or something that I apply, but really what is possible. And that, for me, as long as you can always gravitate to what is most possible in a situation to maximize most potentials, then you're always free. And it really doesn't matter what society you live in.
I just had one quick comment. I lived in Boston for 6 years, and I have seen Noam talk a bunch of times, and there's inevitably somebody that asks him, what should we do, right? And I think It's interesting because I think he can pretty much go anywhere in the country and speak to an audience of 1,000 to 2,000 people in areas that, like, you know, if there were anarchists on the ground there, it would be tremendously painful and a long, rigorous process to mobilize a community meeting about anything else, especially issues relating to, like, poverty or issues in crisis. So, you know, when I appreciate your comments, and to me the question is, you know, not to how to devalue Noam Chomsky or his theories, but, you know, what's going on here? You know, what is it that allows for people to be able to feel comfortable, you know, quoting Noam Chomsky, but not feeling the need to fill out the practice, to fill out the power, to build and challenge, you know, the institutions around them. And, you know, I don't know, I just kind of, I mean, do people have ideas or examples in their communities where, or has anything come up in this conversation that you think, wow, that's something that we'd like to apply, or more comments? Sure. Well, Wayne?
Just a couple of things briefly. One thing which has come up at several places in discussions today, and the being for reforms isn't the same thing necessarily as being reformist. And we tend to keep on making a mistake. The question is, what is the pattern that we're fitting it into? If we're fitting a series of reforms into the pattern, we're going to end up voting for the Democrats or building a Green Party or something. That's reformist. But it's certainly possible to fight for better conditions for working people or whatever, gardens or whatever, to fit that into, at least in our conception, to aim at a revolutionary perspective, and to work side by side with somebody else who's being for the same reform and who himself is, and that person is for a reformist perspective, you know, and they're both legitimate and we're both honest, standing on what we're for. So it's not whether to be for reform or not. I also wanted to, the thing that I think Jason may have said about the gap, because it's very important about between the anarchist perspective and the, and also the first thing that that you said about in the ordinary, about organizing, what kind of anarchist organizing. I think part of the problem is just, it's objective. To the extent that there's a mass, as a mass movement grows, which I believe is happening, starting to happen now, as this mass struggle, it's easier to bridge that gap, to make our radical ideas seem relevant to somebody in terms of the immediate thing about how to make a bigger, better job, and so whatever. As long as there's an enormous gap, as long as we're a fairly low level of struggle, then the gap between that and the revolutionary vision is going to be enormous. And there's no way we can be, you know, no matter how brilliant we are, or how great propaganda we put out or something, that gap is just going to be enormous. And to the extent that the struggle heats up, as I think it is, it's going to be easier and easier. So we should look, I think we can have some kind of hope and optimism on that, that it will become easier over time.
So you had a comment?
Oh, I just wanted to ask, one of the things that came up in the introduction was the issue of funding. And this is something that my anarchist group struggles with a lot, because we're surrounded by groups that get funding and who feel threatened that our unfunded group is doing the same work that they are. So it puts us in tension with a lot of liberal organizations. And I wonder if the speakers could sort of be very honest about their funding sources and how that influences their work, because I think that's something we all grapple with.
CIA.
You must mean AFL-CIA.
No, sorry.
Culinary Institute of America funds me.
I'll go first. The workers, we actually get a very small amount of money from unions, a larger amount from individuals, and, you know, $10-$20 donations, but most of it comes from foundations. I mean, that's why we're incorporated as a nonprofit, so we can do that, and it's always been that way.
Well, early on we just had no money for it.
Yeah, a long time.
You know, and actually most of the work that I've done is not with the Worker Center after it started, but is with my local union, so dues money.
But, you know, I mean, in terms of the competition for funding thing, there is no good way around that. We had a problem where there are organizations that were actually writing grants on our work, they were not working with us, they were not involved, and we'd find out about it. So, and they're particularly threatened by people who work quite hard and don't do it for money and don't do it with a budget. There are a lot of ways to get that money, and, if you need it, you should do it. And if they're not doing anything, then they don't deserve to get it.
I guess in terms of OCAP, we used to get more union funding. We got less union funding after June 15th, 2000, the riot at Queen's Park. So it was gone. It was completely gone.
Also, when Harris came about.
Yeah, but funding is kind of the level of struggle usually equates to the level of funding we kind of receive from individual, kind of from people just or from individual locals or organizations in terms of once there's a high level of struggle with OCAP, then people actually do support us. In terms of the taxi drivers, I mean, and Canada is very different. There are none of these foundations. Most of the left is broke as hell. Like, we're the only organization in Toronto with an office on most of the radical left. I mean, there is a info shop, and people have cubby holes at certain places, but the left in Canada is, especially the radical left, is very broke. I mean, extremely broke. I mean, most organizers, the way they organize is they're on welfare, to be honest, is how they can stay full-time organizers. In terms of the taxi drivers, they felt that it was necessary. I mean, there was a defense fund, and if people look at the back of the strike issue, the NEFAC, the Ontario NEFAC paper strike, they thankfully printed our defense fund call out on their back page, and I think it's on the table in the book fair. But the way they wanted to fund themselves is that they felt that building a movement couldn't be like charity. So the services that, Wayne's holding it up. And that the way that they fund themselves, they saw it as extremely political. They saw it as they didn't want to get money from bigger unions. They didn't want to get money from organizations. That would be nice. That would be sort of ideal as well. But they felt that if OCAP was going to fight tickets for taxi drivers, and if there was going to be services in this thing, that it wasn't an issue of charity, that they were equally as invested in that process, and that they wanted to really see people actually pay every month, that drivers were paying into this thing every month, that they were all actually invested, no matter how small the amount of money they could put in, but that this wasn't a thing of charity, that this was them building their own organization, them building their own struggle, and them supporting each other, because one day they'll realize that you can't rely on a bureaucratic institution to help you out, or the brokerages, the taxi brokerages, it's a very complex industry, to help out when one of their fellow taxi drivers dies and their body needs to be sent back to Iran or to Egypt or to wherever, and that these brokerages that are technically their employers don't give a rat, shit about these people, especially when they die, that they only have each other to support on, and that's how they're going to fund their organizing effort. So in terms of the taxi driver organizing, most of our money is relied upon by the drivers themselves paying monthly, almost in a very dues-like structure without being a union.
With the urban gardening and youth work, very foundation-based, which is definitely limiting, working towards a membership base, but a lot of that is kind of a liberal environmental base, which is also limiting. But in terms of harm-free zone work, of course, that's all volunteer and, but in New York City, they're looking to, within 6 months or something, hire a full-time organizer to be, you know, one of the, or more than one, to be the part of that neighborhood council. And that's not something we think is possible in Worcester to be able to do that kind of fundraising anytime soon for a neighborhood council. There's just a lot more that needs to be done before then. So, yeah, important question.
Other questions, comments? Okay.
Yeah, first of all, I want to thank all of you and Camille for doing this discussion. It's one of the better ones I've had today. Jason, earlier you had said that having so many anarchists in the Downtown Workers Union on the organizing committee was a liability because it prevented you from finding the leaders in the different job sites. I'm not quite sure I understand why.
There's different approaches to organizing, I guess, but if you're working with a group of people and a given workplace, you know, you're looking for the people who are who bring people with them. They are the leaders, and they can be ugly people, fat people, bad people, good people. I don't care, tall, short, whatever. But for better or for worse, they're the leaders, right? And they are the people that people come to when they have a problem that they need to be fixed, when they need to figure something out at work. I mean, I'm just talking about the work context, but I think the process is largely the same in a given community. When they have something they need to fix at work, when they need somebody's advice, and they may lead one person and they may lead 50, right? And in terms of putting together an organization in a given workplace, they are the people you want. Right? Because they're listening to people, they're hearing what people are saying, and people respect them. And if they're saying, this is something we need to do, and we need to form a union, we need to do this, we need to go on strike, that's going to carry a lot of weight. And if you have the wrong people, doesn't matter how right you are, you're never going to get to where you need to go, because nobody's going to listen to what they say. And I was working on a campaign recently, went to this lady's house, she freaked out, how'd you find me, leave me alone, blah, blah. Next day, she writes a letter. It's the very beginning of the campaign. She writes a letter to all her coworkers, hands it to them personally. The union bothered me at home, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, my God, right? We're in such trouble, you know? Didn't make a whit of difference because this woman's nuts. And nobody respects her. Now, if I'd happened to get the wrong person, we would have been dead in the water, right? So that, you know, I think that that's a good discipline, and that in order to move forward, you must have the right people, right? And, you know, I mean, sometimes it drives me crazy that that's the way people are, that certain people are leaders and certain people aren't. But, you know, I mean, sometimes it changes too, obviously, right? Certain people want to become leaders. They work really hard. I see that in unions a lot. But I think we had these people who came in and they worked really hard and they sociable, and some of them are quite good organizers, but they weren't necessarily the leaders in that sort of genuine sense in their particular workplaces. And so it allowed us to make a shortcut, you know, and they were willing to do a lot of things because they were, you know, committed revolutionaries, you know, not committed union people where they work. And, you know, that was a shortcut we should not have made. You know, and I think it's on everybody's back on that one, you know. So, you know, I'm not sure if I would do it again. You know, I think we certainly shouldn't have had as many given the, like, overall size of the organizing committee. They were a very large percentage. I think that was definitely a mistake.
Sarah? I was just kind of thinking about this question about how do we make, because there's this question of what makes the best community organizing, and that's kind of linked to the question of what's the best short-term strategy and how to fix that, and how to fit that into the best long-term strategy, because it seems like the best short-term strategy for community organizing might not always match up exactly with what the best long-term strategy is. There might be places where, like, what seems like going to get you the goal of community organizing faster isn't going to always get people on a place of anarchist, like, towards an larger anarchist movement the best, and how that fits into this question of, do you have a movement of anarchists versus an anarchist movement? And I was just kind of wondering from your experiences, like, do you see that where do you see the long-term strategy fitting into these short-term goals? Do you see it in terms of like more democracy and how the decisions are made, you know, and like the institutions you're trying to set up is coming out of the community organizing? Do you see it in terms of, you know, you talked about the shortfalls of trying to just straight out talk about anarchism and pass up the literature? Do you like see it happening over this long-term radicalization? Where do you see those kind of key points at which the movement goes from community organizing into a larger anarchist movement?
I think,
and do you want to go? Because you haven't.
I guess for, you know, just speaking from my experience at the Worker Center, and I promise I'll keep it short. You know, it was sort of trying to do both things at once. It was very important to keep the energy going, to have short-term victories, and to keep people engaged, and to keep people feeling powerful. You know, like, yes, I can do something about this, and yes, I won in my workplace by getting together with all of these other people, and so 2 weeks from now, when it happens two towns away from me, I feel like I can do something about it, and they show up there, you know, and that keeps people feeling really engaged. And, you know, as a strategy, it works really well because people keep coming, and it's by people getting together and talking and challenging their bosses and challenging, you know, the legislature, that the changes were really happening that we saw. But by combining that with doing the work of talking to people, whether it be one-on-one or in smaller groups, apart from those, you know, moments of passion and when you're out, you know, on a picket line or when you're out, you know, sitting in the boss's office or whatever, making sure that you have the conversation about how this isn't about just here and now and this one thing today. This is about, you know, challenging this larger structure. This is about you actually having the power to do something about it. This is about you not just calling, you know, your friends and complaining that your boss didn't give you your last paycheck. This is actually getting together with your friends and saying, fuck that, we're gonna go and make that person give you your last paycheck. You know, it's like, so it's challenging just the way we even look at our role in a workplace or in the economy. Does that make sense? It's a lot of work, though.
I think for me, in terms of like the long term, or in the short term, and I mean it's a medium term, is that, and as anarchists, understanding different struggles, and understanding that they all have a common enemy, and that they're all actually a common struggle. Mm-hmm. No matter if the face of that is very different, whether that's a community garden or a harm-free zone, to worker struggles, to those who, you know, the lumpen proletariat or those on welfare, that there's a common struggle and that there's a common enemy. And I think that's the biggest contradiction, and it's beginning to make that very clear to those people who are involved in those individual struggles. And concretely, within OCAP and within the taxi drivers, one example was that the mayor of Toronto is hosting this mayoral conference in late October, and we felt that it would have been a great opportunity in terms of to politically like develop and for the taxi drivers who were like, we want to call a demonstration, that we want to call an action to embarrass the mayor over treating immigrant workers as second-class citizens. And that, but if we made that not just about taxi drivers, if we made that about street vendors, if we made that about people living on the streets who face kind of police harassment under the Safe Streets law, if we, to the different kind of constituencies, that they could actually, Mohawk Nation of Tyendinaga, who's soon gonna receive the dump of the garbage dump from Toronto, that here you could have an actual challenge to authority, to the municipal government, led by one struggle, but linked to all these other struggles, then you're actually building that analysis, and then you're actually making those contradictions clear that, wait a minute, that my struggle is no different than that of the Mohawk Nation. Well, no, it's more complicated than that. It's very different. But at the same time, actually seeing a common enemy, and that those struggles are actually common at certain points, that's how you're actually growing, and that's how you're actually making those contradictions clear, and that moving it from just this kind of short-term isolated community organizing into an actual political movement that can then actually take on and really, really take on the state and really take on capitalism. And we jumped the gun where taxi drivers were like, look, we're still building ourselves. We just wanted to be a taxi driver demo right now, that taxi drivers themselves aren't ready to say that we're going to join this march with all these other organizations and or with all these other struggles. And that's fine, but the medium-term goal is to eventually to get to that point before this government is out in the city of Toronto, where that they can actually be part of a larger struggle and create that larger struggle. And that I think that's something that as anarchists we can actually bring to the table, that we know all these struggles are linked, and that it's getting to the people that we're trying to organize to the point of seeing all these struggles actually being linked, and seeing and showing that there is a common enemy, and that creating that I think is really important in terms of creating a medium term vision in terms of struggle.
I think the work that we do, we're trying to expose not only societal and political contradictions, but also the contradictions within the terrain that we're struggling, whether it be, you know, working with social service agencies or our labor unions. A democratic impulse of direct democracy and horizontalism are ways that we can contribute to local struggles, but also highlight components of our ideological process. But it's, to me, it's not an either or. Like I value people spending time and developing theory. But my critique is that, you know, it seems irrational to, and it's bad power analysis. Like if you develop that totally abstract from any commitment to implementing that, you know, and it becomes almost this like determinist argument that we know Marx was wrong about, that we're just waiting for stuff to happen. How do we connect those ideas? Because sometimes the majoritarian nature of mass movements, you know, are going to lend themselves to, or populism, or, you know, are going to lend themselves to becoming reactionary. And we can't be naive about that. And we have to, you know when to switch our focus. But we won't have a chance in implementing any of our ideas if we're content with a holding and just staying amongst ourselves. And to me, that's the the biggest challenge of it not being either or. And other comments or questions? The person behind McKay, and then you.
Sure. Hi. Thank you for your discussion and the talk. I appreciate it. I work with a group called the Organic Collective in San Diego, and one thing that we recently decided to do was to become explicit about our anarchist politics. And instead of trying to work with groups and attract people and try to kind of have this like quiet whispering, like, oh yeah, we're anarchists too. Their struggles is like being explicit about it. And I think that's actually worked to attract people. I mean, by working hard on issues and by calling yourself anarchists, like, you actually gain respect and gain commitment. And you scare away some of the socialists. But what I'm wondering is that at the same time that we've done that, a lot of the communities we work with don't share this vision and only have temporary alliances with, or strategic temporary coalitions that can actually fall apart really easily because we both agree on this one point, right? Like, we're going to stop this group. Like, we work on vigilante issues, right? We're going to stop vigilantes, but that's it. You go away. So I'm wondering how you sustain coalitions or sustain agreements beyond temporary actions, events, or struggles
and yet still maintain an ex vote.
Well, I mean, I think that's the question, right? You know, if you're serious about building a movement, then and you're interested in something that's more than episodic in nature, right? And the question is, how do you build something that's lasting, right? For us, we chose to, I mean, the biggest fights that we've been involved in have been in coalition with unions and with churches, two groups that, well, unions, but I mean, I'm Jewish and not, and secular, so I'm just not that crazy about churches to begin with, and then I'm an anarchist, right? So, but I mean, our decision to work with those groups was based on the fact that we were in the beginning doing a lot of, like, I think what most sort of radical activists do, which is you build sort of individual relationships with people and get them to join your group, you know, and you get the group bigger and bigger. And then, you know, over time it falls apart, right? I mean, that, I mean, you, maybe you have a good group in the last 4 or 5 years, or maybe not so long, right? But the truth is you don't have the real organic, or whatever the right term is, ties that hold people together, which are usually around family and work and where they live or their religion. And so we noticed that the groups that we were being able to build lasting ties with, and when I say unions, I should say, you know, sometimes I just mean that we're working with like individual stewards in a workplace who will work with us to mobilize our coworkers. I don't always mean some sort of official relationship with the union staff and all that sort of stuff. But and then the churches, which were just huge when we were working on minimum wage stuff, and they were lasting, and they could make commitments, and they were there time after time, and it wasn't that they were gone, you know. And so, you know, for us, we made an analysis about who we could work with to build in a bigger, stronger movement, you know, and it led into working with people that, I mean, there's a lot of dangers there in terms of trying to build a bigger radical movement. If two of your biggest partners are churches and unions, right, that's, it's not like they're really signing up for the overthrow of capitalism. You know, that's not their goal. On the other hand, we were able to get after things for a number of years to win serious victories. And if we had not made that decision to try to find a way to work with these organizations, it wouldn't have happened, you know. So, you know, I think one of the reasons the anarchist movement is so episodic, or, you know, seem like, is because it fetishizes tactics, right? You know, I mean, there's just this, like, you can only do things that fit in within certain principles. I always thought it was supposed to be by any means necessary, you know? And, you know, you have to look at your tactics in terms of what builds your organization, you know? And building your organization is not just like, oh, we're doing bigger and more people know about us, but, you know, what does that really mean? You know, do you break that down in terms of how many people you can mobilize, or what your actual paying membership is, or, you know, it's different for everybody, right? But most of the time, I think that the tactics that people pick, working in coalition, doing demonstrations, these sorts of things, are not actually all that good for organization building. You know, I mean, they may fit the right principle, but they're frustrating for building organizations. And, you know, I mean, you can go through an entire union campaign and you might never ever have a rally. You know, that might never happen just because it's not relevant. So, you know, I think that, you know, in terms of building anarchism or anarchist organizations, you know, I think that instead of always working in coalitions or as individuals on things, and it gets back to what you were asking about before, we, and I don't know if anarchists are really up for it, we really have to be the organizations we're always working in coalition with, right? I mean, if you start an anarchist union, you know, and it's clear from the beginning what it is, and you're working with people and you say, this is what the organization is, we want to work with you, you have these issues, there are no illusions. Now, I mean, it's theirs. I guess, you know, if they join and they're successful, they could eventually change it and run that risk, right? But, I mean, this whole idea, which is essentially, you know, an anarchist form of permeationism, right, that we're going to get into these coalitions and build alliances and change people. You know, I mean, I think sometimes they respect us and they respect individuals, but it doesn't seem to work very well, you know, in terms of building this broader anarchist movement, you know. So I think that maybe some of the things that people did in Spain are something we should look at a little closer. But I think most of the time we don't, because we're small and broke and, you know, how do we do that? But, you know, it works for them. It should work for us, you know, if we're serious enough.
Yeah, I don't know, like, I don't know how many people here have ever been part of a socialist organization, but that was me a while ago. That was ugly. And, yeah, Youth for Socialist Action, 16 and 17 years old. But, like, one thing that, like, what, I mean, I don't know, like, one thing that was really, I found, dysfunctional about socialist groups that I was part of as a teenager, not only were they, like, youth cults, but, it was just, like, this idea all the time of, like, you know, talking about, like, you know, building this socialist movement almost in the sense of, like, we're going to go out there and we're going to brainwash people to, like, pick up the red flag and, like, be socialists just like us, and, like, Marx said it, and therefore it's true. And I think one of the things that, like, really turned me on to anarchism was seeing, and then getting involved with, like, more community-based organizations, and seeing that, like, the like, a lot of the people, you know, who were kind of the driving forces behind it were anarchists themselves. And I think that's where, like, anarchists have really succeeded, is, like, in our ability to, like, step up but also step back in a certain sense, and to, like, you know, not be that vanguard kind of, like, you know, this is, like, the grand way to do it type thing. And not necessarily, like, preaching, like, a certain kind of politics. Can't remember what the other part I wanted to say, so maybe I'll just leave it at that. Yeah.
So is there anyone, there's two people that have spoken before that are on stack, but is there anyone that hasn't spoken that would like to add a comment?
The idea that you step up, and then it's interesting what you're saying. I just wanted to get a little bit further clarification. So to step up and lead for a certain point or a certain period of time, then step back, and then see if by virtue of stepping up that time for that period of time, it gets rolling in a certain way, and then you feel like, or one feels like they can then kind of retreat in a little way. Is that what you were?
No.
I don't mean retreat politically, but I mean just sort of step away and let others then just kind of continue the momentum.
I mean the stepping back more in the sense that, like I've found the real successes that, you know, the real, like, visionary anarchists that I've known are the ones that are, like, the least sectarian. So stepping back in terms of, like, working in community organizations, but, like, not necessarily, you know, pushing forth, you know, some sort of a grand ideology to people who aren't coming from radical anarchist backgrounds, you know, with the realization that, you know, like, a real movement comes through, you know, empowerment and like, getting people to act and like, a lot of the stuff that people here were describing.
Just that at least some of us come from an anarchist tradition that distinguishes two types of organizations, at least two types. One being the anarchist organization of anarchists committed to a particular program, those who agree to a program, the other being a broader, the union, the community organization, or whatever. And if you make this kind of distinction, to some extent, I think it solves some of the problems, because you don't have to try to make the union into the anarchist organization. You don't have to make all the taxi drivers, you know, all be anarchists. It's just not your goal. You know, you want to work together with everybody who's the taxi driver or whatever. At the same time, you could separately be working with people to help coordinate your activities and help build your ideas as anarchists. If you don't try to make them both do the same thing, then I think it's easier, and it solves some of the difficulties. And it doesn't mean that you've got to have your organization, like some of the socialist organizations, try to become the bosses, the secret or the open leaders of the organization. You know, it could be your job to just just doing your job and to be fighting for as democratic organizations as possible.
I would like to add something to that. I mean, early on when we were sort of bridging that, going from just like talking about anarchist ideas or, and sort of when we were first starting out actually doing community organizing, it was so nourishing to have that anarchist organization to go back to and to say, to sort of break it into pieces and have that safe place to say, like, was that really fucked up or was that the right thing to do? And to really challenge each other. And I mean, that's why we joined Love and Rage, was because as a little group of anarchists out in the woods of Vermont, we really felt like we needed some more connection, people who would challenge us and say, well, did you think about this? Did you think about that? How come you're doing it this way? And that was really important to us in the beginning. I mean, not like it's less important now, but it definitely was important.
I just wanted to, I think that's a another kind of important, not just even vision, but how do we actually create that vision or the, those spaces of debate and spaces of anarchist organization? I too come from a background of maybe one of the worst socialist traditions, or I was a member of the, I guess in the States, they've split twice, I'm not sure, the ISO. I was in the IS, I guess, for 4 years in Canada.
This confession time.
Yeah, this confession time. But and
I'll take out the garbage.
and one serious anybody else? I saw you at the convention 4 years ago.
Founder of the IS.
I mean, is a serious need of even a space where sometimes even OCAP as an organization can sometimes feel like a cadre organization more than it is an actual broad organization, because that is where, I mean, most of the decisions are made by these very key organizers or people who play a much more active role. And so those debates, because you feel that sometimes, I mean, those spaces where you can debate the next step, but you can't debate two steps ahead of the game. And you can't actually do that as radical sometimes within those organizations. So it's those, I mean, sometimes how do we create spaces outside of that or organization outside of that? And I think that, I mean, there's always a bunch of examples, and I think in our city sometimes lacks, or at least organization that appeals to people that are actually trying to really create serious struggle on the ground, that sometimes this or, like organizations actually lack. So it's how do we concretely begin to debate two steps ahead of the game with each other? And is it spaces like this? Is it you know, what kind of organization I think is also really important as well, if we, you know, if, I mean, that's a whole debatable question as well, whether people feel organization is relevant or not. But to me, more lately, and especially in a period of where you feel you're in a downturn, I think organization becomes more relevant, because as radicals, for me, I can debate people informally and I can have those discussions informally, but once you begin to lose a sense of tradition, and I think that being in the IS, that sense of tradition or that revolutionary tradition that you can still have when you're an anarchist, but when it lacks organization, it takes a very different form, and it creates this fog, and you stop becoming, there becomes a lack of clarity. So I think in terms of long-term vision for radicals, I think the question of organization has to become really, really important. I think that unfortunately we only really begin to touch on at the end of this discussion as well.
I mean, one of the things that, you know, cadre is kind of a taboo term, and I was thinking another one is front group, right? And so like how do we engage without
becoming, like, we're trying to form fund groups, and how do we push for democracy and push for parts that might be relevant in parts of our methodology and idealism, but differentiate ourselves. And that's a difficult tension. I mean, there's been a lot of groups that, you know, just debate endlessly, yeah, whether you should call yourself this or that. And I mean, to me, what's refreshing is if people can recognize, like, the power analysis and where we are, our weaknesses and strengths, in as far as the social construction and where we're at. And I think that helps frame that discussion, because otherwise it becomes more just like a discussion around infiltration and underhanded. So and it really undercuts our potential of bringing real tools that are pragmatic to struggle, you know, and have been co-opted by, you know, bureaucratic labor movements or, you know, community groups that are still self-policing. And from the McCarthy era, that's a strong tradition in this country. You know, we censor ourselves. So if we can figure out how to strategically, you know, be in the debate of the oppressed, be in the debate of the exploited. And the only way we're going to do that is by having relationships and struggle in those. And I'm interested in other, I think there's a lot of implicit ideas about how radicalization happens that we don't really talk about. And I'm interested in those conversations. I mean, that's what brought me into community organizing, because I saw on a small level, they were producing increased political participation. Was it the kind of political participation in the long run that's going to be a revolution? You know, I'm not certain that is always the place for it, but there's tools there, and I feel like we don't often do that. So I'm really appreciative. I like to thank everyone for coming, and there's more comments. There's going to be a couple announcements, but if anyone wants to stay after that, you know, feel free to, you know, hang around and ask more questions, or if any of the panelists have closing comments.
I would say one thing quickly, which is, you know, I think one of the reasons Love and Rage fell apart was that, you know, we prioritized mass work. And then it sort of got to this point where people were like, well, why do we really need this Love and Rage collective? I mean, at least here, I don't know that much about around the rest of the country. And so I think, you know, somebody was saying earlier, when you don't have a mass movement, it's kind of this gulf. And I think that's right. You know, I mean, that was a real tension, you know, and I think having radical groups is actually really important. I mean, I like to slag off on radicals, but it's actually a huge deal, and it's very important, and it's the only way that more revolutionaries are produced, right, is by working with other revolutionaries in struggle, you know, and that goes away when you don't have organization as radicals explicitly, you know, and particularly I think localization does not work in the long run, you know. You need a bigger, broader geographical network to refer to. So, you know, it's really like a razor's edge to walk. On the one hand, of trying to be relevant and change things, and on the other hand, of remembering why you got into this. And I would just say, you know, I think with the Worker Center, we got sucked way into the world of unions, too far in. And we've been like sort of trying to find our way back out a little bit, you know. And that's a learning process we had to go through. But I think it is the tension of, you know, trying to build a real movement that's also has the potential to be revolutionary.
Just that there's a very urgent case in Canada, a person who's been on day 79 of a hunger strike. And if people aren't aware, the IRA political prisoners were on hunger strike. I mean, the earliest 41, 43 days, the longest 63 or 64 days before dying. And this person's on day 79. His name is Mohamed Mahjoub, who's what they call a secret trial detainee on a national security certificate in Canada that allows the Canadian state to imprison indefinitely people who are quote-unquote suspected terrorists without having any real evidence, without ever bringing any charge to them, but just because they're not citizens.
You want me to give the
spiel? Yeah.
The campaign to stop sequel trials has been going on in Canada for about 2.5 years. Right now there's 5 Muslim men detained under a security certificate. We managed to get one out of jail in Montreal in February. But essentially it's a piece of legislation that the Canadian government passed in 93 under the Immigration Act, saying that people that are permanent residents can be detained without having a charge laid on them, just under the notion that CSIS, the secret agent, the secret intelligence agency in Canada, deems them to be a threat to national security. What that national security threat is irrelevant because they never have to say. And so essentially these people are held indefinitely in provincial prisons, even though, and don't receive the treatment as federal prisoners, and can be detained for years. And right now, one of them has been detained for over 5 years. Majoub's been on strike now for 79 days because he has many children, and he's asking to be able to have contact visits with them once a month. And you know, his wife, Mona, is really afraid that she's gonna become a widow with all of these children very soon, unless the Ontario government and the Canadian government responds and changes just the basic like rights for him to have contact visits. The trials, the case is going on for him as well as the 4 other men. And if you want to know more about the campaign to stop the secret trials, to abolish the security certificates, I'm more than willing to talk about it at great lengths, but that's just the superfluous details that you need to know. It's a horrible situation. It's out of control, and yeah, it's happening.